Hello and welcome to the National Oceanography Centre's Into the Blue podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Zoe Jacobs. Today I'm joined by Dr. Jenny Brown to find out all about some of the approaches and methods of protecting our coastal communities. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jenny. It's really good to see you. Before we start getting into it, I wondered if you could tell us a bit about your background, your career at NOC, what kind of projects you've been on and things like that.
Oh, thanks for having me, Zoe. So I've been a coastal oceanographer at the NOC for the last 15 years. This has been my only real job since leaving uni, to be honest, so I must love what I do. And my projects have been looking at flood and erosion risk, how we understand processes and working with local authorities to get our research out into the real world.
Okay, cool. So it sounds like you've worked on quite a few projects that involve coastal resilience, which is our topic for today. So wondering if you could tell us, so historically, how has the UK managed coastal hazards? What kind of defences have we put in place to protect our coastal communities?
Well, in the past, we were very reactive. So when there was large hazard events, big floods, so the 1953 flooding events, we reacted to those. And that's when we started putting in sea defences, sea walls, the Thames Barrier. But as we move forward, we've started to realise we need much more sustainable ways of protecting our coastline. We can't keep building infinitely high sea walls. Mm. And everything has a design life. And with climate change, that design life has a fixed period in time when it provides the level of protection that we require.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I guess looking towards maybe more natural solutions in future, which I guess we'll come on to later. So what about protecting people living on the coast? So how, you mentioned seawalls, how effective actually are they?
Well, a seawall is very effective. The problem is when you put a seawall in, then people get a sense of security and the communities start to build up behind them. So if they do fail, then there's a larger community behind them that could be impacted by that flood event. But going forwards, we're starting to realise that we need to live with changing conditions. In front of seawalls, water levels are rising, so that means larger waves reach our seawalls. Larger waves means more beach erosion and also greater impact, so more waves spraying over the top of seawalls. So as we go around our daily lives, we might live behind them, but we might also commute to work along coastal roads or coastal railway lines. Mm. We start to feel the impacts of flooding more frequently, and we need to be able to forecast when extreme events are going to happen, so we can plan our journeys and protect our properties.
Yeah, I guess seawalls might be the most kind of familiar kind of coastal defence that we have in the UK for some people. I grew up in Portsmouth, so living quite near to the shoreline, I mean, there's a massive seawall that goes all the way along there, so I'm very familiar with those kind of things. And especially when there's kind of major storms coming in, I know quite a lot of people that actually go there specifically to watch the waves kind of crashing over the edge of the seawall.
And they take photos, which is actually really
dangerous. I know, and that's what I was thinking. Yeah. Like, it doesn't seem like a good idea. Yeah. But with, especially with climate change, right? So what are we anticipating to happen with climate change for things like sea level rise and waves and things like that?
Well, rising sea level means the water levels are deeper in front of our seawalls. So that means waves are being raised up higher, so they can go over the top of our seawalls. Yeah. Also, wind conditions are changing. So if storm tracks change, onshore winds also blow dense plumes of spray over the top of seawalls. And that can be hazardous because large wave events can be carrying debris from the beach. Maybe there's cobbles on the beach. If they're picked up and thrown across the seawall, it could go through your window, they could go through your car windscreen if you're parked behind a seawall.
Yeah, that's true. So is the kind of rising sea level and I guess increased storminess and more waves and things like that, is that just going to be a case of it's now just going to kind of go over the top of the seawall, or is it actually going to affect the seawall itself? I imagine it's getting repeatedly bashed by lots of wave action, it might get damaged.
Yeah, so a seawall will experience fatigue. Yeah. Concrete only has a certain design life as well.
Okay.
And that's why local authorities monitor the condition of sea defences, and they have planned maintenance work as well. But also we're trying to change the way we manage our coasts. Mm. So move away from the concrete, start having habitat restoration. So where our beach levels are perhaps eroding, we need to compensate for this in other locations as well. And we're now trying to green the grey a little bit more and use softer approaches to coastal management.
That's really interesting. Can you tell me a bit more about that? Give me maybe an example.
Yeah. So in 2011, the Dutch put in something called a sand motor. Now that is a mega nourishment. So very often when we talk about beach nourishment, maybe we go to the beach, we kind of put sand deposits on the beach every 5 years. But that's quite invasive for the habitats that are on the beach. So the Dutch did a mega nourishment, which is designed to last 20 years. And the waves and the tidal currents actually move the sediment from this large deposit and spread it along the coastline. So people don't have to be there with their diggers on such a high frequency.
That's really interesting. Have we got anything like that happening in the UK?
We do. So we have been looking at similar types of intervention. The problem is we don't have all sandy coastlines. So we've got muddy coasts, gravel coast, cliff coast. So you don't want to put the wrong type of sediment in a location and then spread it so it interferes with the natural habitat.
Yeah, I know I've heard of kind of habitat compensation for things like flooding, maybe more to manage kind of river plains and things like that, but are there things that are kind of in the pipeline or even happening at the moment where we can, I don't know, transform a certain landscape into like marshland or something like that, as you said, a more natural protection?
Yeah, so Hesketh Outmarsh in the Ribble Estuary, which is just north of Liverpool, is a nice example. So that's actually a habitat compensation scheme for engineered defences that went in Morecambe Bay. But by flooding farmers' fields, the salt marsh has grown up, and now that acts as a buffer itself. So as a salt marsh establishes, that kind of absorbs waves like a big sponge at the beach, a bit of a shock absorber, while it's also providing habitats for the birds. So it brings a lot more benefits. It's not just natural protection, it's also benefits that are linked to health and well-being. It's a lovely place to go running or perhaps walk your dog.
Yeah, kind of increasing the area, like our nature that we have. That's really cool. So that, because traditionally I always think of our kind of coastal defences as like the concrete sea wall. So it's really nice to hear that actually we're moving, not always I guess, but like in some areas where we can, towards that kind of natural restoration, which I guess is better for everyone if it works. That's really cool. So we were just saying that so sea level rise is going to present a much greater risk to people, especially those living on or near the coast. How are we planning to manage that? Is there going to be kind of like better or increased forecasting?
Well, we already have a very good hazard forecasting service. So that's run by government agencies. The Met Office have numerical predictions for the UK. The Environment Agency issue flood alerts. But we're always learning new information. So a lot of research. We monitor conditions, and as we get more understanding, we can then improve the numerical tools that we use to predict what's going to happen. So we're always trying to reduce false alerts or missed alerts and try and improve information. And with new digital technologies, we're always wanting to get this information into more accessible sat-nav information. So perhaps when you're driving down the motorway, your sat-nav will tell you that there's congestion and you reroute you. Or maybe your sat-nav can start telling you, well, a coastal road is closed at high tide because it's stormy on that high tide, and reroute you as well. And that will help stop people driving or walking into flood hazardous zones.
Yeah. And we talked about kind of commuting or it affecting our vehicles or our trains and things like that. So I went to Cornwall in the summer on the train, and as I was kind of going through Dawlish, I was kind of reminded of when that whole section of rail line just kind of fell into the sea, didn't it? Some of our listeners might remember that. I can't remember how long that was, 5 years ago maybe?
That was February 2014.
Gosh, yeah. Oh my gosh, quite a long time ago then. But I just remember it being quite a big deal at the time. Are things like that more likely to happen? I guess that I guess the Network Rail have got quite a good forecasting system in place as well.
Yeah, so while climate change impacts extremes, sea level rise is also changing the frequency of these more minor flooding events. Yeah. So sometimes it's called nuisance flooding. So on the Dawlish railway line, you've got the waves overtopping the sea defence. If that happens more regularly, then there'll be more train delays or speed limit restrictions, yeah, and that creates more transport disruption. So then there's a lot of costs implicated with that. So then they start weighing up the cost benefit of changing the seawall design,
yeah,
or sometimes even relocating. Can when it gets too bad, can you actually put a line in elsewhere? So when they're thinking about kind of the next 100 years, they will be looking at a range of different options and weighing up the costs and benefits of each.
Yeah, that makes sense, doing a kind of cost benefit analysis of all these different places. Are there some places that just can't be protected?
I guess there's places you can intervene anywhere you're willing, yeah, to, but you've got to always look at the cost, the benefits.
Yeah,
and sometimes the benefits aren't just the flood damages and the monetary costs, it's also the health and well-being impacts as well.
Yeah, exactly. As you just said, kind of sometimes relocation is actually just the best kind of way to manage that kind of situation. Can't manage everything. Is there anything people can do themselves?
Yeah, so you might start seeing floodgates appearing in people's garden walls. Sometimes some of the small towns on the south coast, you'll see they've got floodgates in their doorways, concrete barriers, and they're like secondary defences. So if a seawall hasn't been increased in height, then overtopping can occur and the streets might become flooded. So people are starting to protect their own homes. Maybe the air bricks, the vents in your house, perhaps you have them at a higher level. Maybe you have steps or a ramp going into your property in a higher doorway. So, some people are starting to have kind of electrics higher up, so the plugs aren't at ground level. Or maybe you have carpet upstairs, but not downstairs. So people are starting to modify their homes.
Yeah, kind of like forward planning, because I think I've seen lots of houses near the coast or on the news or whatever, like protecting with sandbags. That seems to be like the most traditional way to protect water coming in, but I guess you have to think, if you're living in an area that is quite prone to flooding, these kind of floodgates, which I've actually not heard of before, what do they actually look like? Are they sort
so
of concrete?
They're big, no, they're like metal barriers.
Yeah.
So in a lot of modern seawalls, people don't like to park behind them to have their fish and chips and not be able to see the sea. So you'll find big gaps along a seawall, and if you look closely, you'll notice there's a big metal gate that can be shut when there's a forecasted flood event, to kind of maintain the barrier all along the length of the defence. But then when it's nice and sunny, they're open and people can actually see the sea.
Oh, that's nice. Talking of barriers, we haven't actually mentioned the Thames barrier, but that is, I mean, how long has that been in place? It's quite a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So people might be familiar with the Thames barrier in London. Is that the kind of thing that's going to be needed in future to protect big cities?
Well, it will depend if the city's on an estuary and whether they're at a risk of surge. Some cities are at risk of river flooding as well.
Yeah.
So what we need is good forecast to be able to know when to close barriers.
Yeah.
And also, because it's been there a long time, with sea level rise, how long is it going to last? Do we need to change the barrier? Do we need to add other other defences, yeah, alongside it? Flood storage is something that could be looked into. Are there downriver locations where we can collect the water?
Yeah. Gosh, there's lots of things kind of being thought about and in the pipeline. It's really good. And I know NOC is doing quite a lot of great work to transform our coastal management systems. Can you tell us a bit about what projects we're involved in?
Yeah, so we're trying to develop a new sensor that actually measures in individual waves that go over the top of sea defences. So very often this type of information is collected in flumes, but a flume within a laboratory doesn't quite get all of the real conditions that interact and all the different coastal locations. Everything's very unique.
Yeah.
So by collecting measurements on site, we hope to be able to tailor hazard warning systems, mm-hmm. to have site-specific trigger levels so we know when conditions are actually hazardous, and get a better understanding of what's going on, and also use the data that we collect as training data for new predictive tools that can be used to help forecast what will happen at different locations.
That's interesting. So we're going more in terms of projects, we're looking at more of a kind of forecasting.
Yeah, so I guess we're looking at observation-driven nowcasting.
Okay.
So by having a sensor that can detect waves, yeah. and then get the information online, yeah. within 10 minutes, hazard responders or the general public can see that data, and can kind of plan around that and help make decisions as an event is unfolding.
Yeah, which I guess is incredibly important.
Yeah.
Is there anything we're doing at NOC, using models to kind of predict maybe future changes or anything else like that?
So we do work a lot with the Met Office, looking, yeah. mainly at climate projections, the larger scale. We don't work so much in the local hazard forecasting, okay, services. Yeah. So we look more at tides, tide surges, wave predictions around the whole of the UK coast, and looking at the uncertainty in those projections going forward, rather than the 24/7 prediction schemes,
yes, exactly.
for flooding.
Yeah. I guess there is quite a lot of uncertainty as well. Yeah, makes life easier, doesn't it? I know there is lots of the models I use as well. So how, just to finish up, how can we educate the public on this?
Well, recently we've created a phone app that accompanies two guided walks, one in Penzance and one in Dawlish. The app goes with about a 30 to 40 minute walk along those seafronts, and it's communicating about coastal change, and it's a it includes digital art, so it has a narration, and also augmented reality, so the user can actually see and experience hazardous conditions, and see beach levels changing when they're walking along the coast on a sunny day. And the aim is to get people to think about change and future change, and start to become more aware of what's going on, and I guess take responsibility for staying safe when flood events do occur.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I'm sure lots of our listeners will be interested in that, so watch this space. Cool. Thank you very much for joining us today, Jenny. Appreciate it. So if you'd like to learn more about coastal defences or our coastal walk experiences, please visit our website at www.noc.ac.uk or click the links in the description. To ensure you don't miss out on future episodes of Into the Blue, subscribe on your favourite podcast app. See you next time.